Well, we had an exciting afternoon on Friday. I was just sort of getting ready for, the kids were coming home and so on. And I had this knock at the door, and I opened it, and someone said, "There's a pig on the loose." And I wondered, are they speaking figuratively? Is this like some kind of a spiritual allusion to something? But indeed, there was a pig on the loose, and it had been in an allotment in Carvely, and everyone had needed some pigs on the allotment. And here it is. And what you'll notice is it is in the vicarage back garden. Because the request, we labelled him Percy the pig, the request was for a place to go that was enclosed. And of course, where do you go? Well, of course, you go to the vicarage with a pig. So Percy hung around in our garden for about 3 hours, dug up quite a lot of it, broke the cat flap trying to get in. This is a 70-kilogram pig trying to get into our cat flap. Basically, it's left in shreds. But anyway, we have this pig, and it made me think about the whole area of people who have livestock. Because, of course, Abraham, the story that we're looking at today, was successful. He was wealthy, and that was measured in his livestock. Now, I don't know whether he had pigs. It was before all the food laws in the Old Testament, so he may have. Certainly had sheep, maybe had some cows. He was a wealthy bloke, and he will have had lots of these sorts of animals, and he looked after them. But in the story that we have today, he has a sort of a vision where God comes to him and appears before Abraham. And he says this to him, "Do not be afraid, Abraham." Notice it's not Abraham, it's Abraham. "I am your shield, your very great reward." And then the promise, "I will make you a great nation and I will bless you." He's had this incredible promise of blessing in a few chapters four in Genesis 12, but then it's repeated. And the promise of blessing is that he's going to have a great big family. Now, at this stage, he's already wealthy. He already has some land, and he's moved. But there is one thing that he doesn't have, and that is he does not have an heir. I put these up last night, and quite a few of the kids weren't quite sure who they were. But I think most of you know who they are, of course. They are the heirs to the throne. And we don't know quite when George is going to get the nod. Goodness knows when. We don't know, frankly, when Charles is going to get the nod. But here they are, your heirs, our heirs to the throne. And of course, for Abraham, that was a big issue, that he didn't have anyone to carry on the family name and also to have to inherit what he had. And he couldn't really see how that was going to happen. Because in the Old Testament, God's blessing was all about big families. That was the idea. On Tuesday, I'm doing a funeral for someone who was the youngest of 11. But let's be honest, that's not very common anymore, is it? And this particular family would have been seen as blessed in the Old Testament, because that's how they understood it. But Abraham turns to God, and he says, "What can you give me since I remain childless?" And there's something in that statement that I think is quite raw and poignant. He's getting on in years now. Sarah, his wife, has never had a baby, and presumably they tried and had, goodness knows what, miscarriages and whatever else had happened. We don't know. We don't know that full story. But they'd have difficulty. And for someone in that situation, where having children is a sign of God's blessing, not having children, of course, is there's a bit of a question mark over your life. Why didn't you have children in that situation back then? We understand it very differently, of course, now. But into this situation and into his sadness, we have this promise. "Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. So shall your offspring be." You are going to be blessed not just with one, but a whole generation, of course, is what he's saying. And the very thing that seemed impossible was the thing that God was going to actually enable to happen. And of course, it wasn't just about offspring, it was about land. "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it." And so what God is saying is your life is going to be blessed not just in terms of livestock, pigs and sheep and cows and whatever else, not just in terms of big family, but also in terms of land to enter into. A big bit of land, I would say about the size of Yorkshire. In other words, his family is going to fill a very large space and going to become a nation. And there are big promises that are being made. Actually, in the Bible, there's lots and lots of different promises that are made. Loads of promises in the Bible. And what's really interesting is that quite often, the people of Israel and God's people don't actually take the promises seriously. Or they do, and then they break them. So God promised us something, and very soon afterwards, something goes wrong. God promises to deliver Israel from Egypt, and he does. And what happens when they get in the desert? They start to grumble. And then they sort of are all delivered, and then they come into the promised land. And then eventually they start to fall out. And you know what happens? Israel is split into two kingdoms, Judah and the rest of Israel. And they have wars and they fight. And yet there's various kings who are faithful, and also the prophets who are faithful. But they don't like the prophets, and so they try to get rid of a lot of them. And so the story is about God promising and the people of Israel trying to, not really quite grasping how to walk into and enter into those promises. And then, of course, Jesus enters the world, and that's the ultimate promise of the Messiah, which is what we're looking forward to at Easter, coming in to bring about salvation. And yet, what happens to Jesus? Well, they don't really like Jesus either, do they? And so he is crucified on the cross. But then Jesus rises again, because that's part of the promise. And the early church forms, and the church grows, and Paul travels, and the church then starts to fight with each other and become dysfunctional. And so Paul writes his letters. And so at each stage, they have promises, and they struggle with them. But the promises are still there. And those promises go right back to this promise in Genesis, that it's going to be an expanding nation of God's people, and not just going to be the people of Israel, but actually going to include people from all over the world. And Jesus makes those amazing promises, doesn't he? You know, I've come to give life and life to the full. I will never leave you or forsake you. Those promises that we have in the Bible. Well, it's a fascinating thing that we look at when we think about those two kinds of ideas of promise and fulfillment and how they work. Because, of course, one of the things that we realize is that to receive a promise, we actually have to, A, believe it, and then do something about it, don't we? That's the issue that we have as Christians. And here is Abraham receiving an incredible promise. A promise that, you know, he's going to have the things that he really has been looking for. He's going to have those things. When we think about promises and receiving God's promises, the really interesting thing is often we flip it very quickly to what we really want. And in the world sort of narrative, what you see in films and in popular culture and in advertising is something like this. Work out what your dreams are and then go after those. Broadly speaking, that's the story, isn't it? Work out your dreams and go for those. The problem is that what we find is that if everyone goes for their dreams, that's fundamentally probably quite selfish. You know, if every child becomes a pop star, for example, or an international footballer, it's quite possible that some of those dreams actually won't be great for them. And so actually in the scriptures, it doesn't really have that approach to promises and life. It's very different. It doesn't talk about achieving your dreams. It talks about entering to God's story. And that's quite different. It's quite different to realizing your dreams and entering to God's story. They're two quite different things. Because God's story is really different. So Abraham had come up with a plan. His plan was that he was going to get his servant to be his heir. Because he'd reached a point where he thought, I can't do this. That was he'd become pragmatic. But God had a much bigger story for him. We all have our plans. We might call them dreams or whatever. We all have those. But the point here is that God has a much bigger story and a much bigger plan. And Abraham here is a part of that. And so he looks up to the stars and he sees what God is capable of. He looks up and he sees what a family would look like. Look at the constellations, the wonder of it. And you see the extraordinary detail. And just these mammoth stars that are huge, but there's billions of them and billions and billions. And he looks up and he sees the galaxies, the constellations, and he realizes that indeed God can create families, and he can create communities, and he can create hope, and he can create joy, and he can create peace. That's the big story. That's the big story in the Bible. And in verse 6, it just says this, very simple. Abraham believed the Lord, and it was credited to him as righteousness. So he had these promises, but he did something else. He believed them. He believed them. Lent really has two focuses as we think about Lent. The first is to see that bigger picture and to become part of that bigger story. And that's why we focus on giving things up. You may have given up wine or chocolate or TV or something like that. That's a bit of a distraction. But the idea is that there is a bigger story, and to see the bigger story, that we have to take those distractions away from us and focus on our spiritual life and fill it with other things. And here we have this amazing moment where Abraham responds to the promise. I think one of the problems that we have today is that we don't respond to the promise. God has all these promises for all of us. It's not just for the vicar, you'll be happy to know, or whoever. It's not just for the, you know, it's for everybody, actually, the promises that God has for those who come to him in faith. But we actually have to believe the promise and do something about it. There is a response called for. And that is what Abraham does so well. He enters into the bigger picture, but then he responds. He believes it, and he acts, and his life is changed. And in the story, there's a sacrifice that's offered. We're not going to be offering any sacrifice. We're asking you to do that. That's all part of it. But the primary thing is about his heart and his mind. And it got me thinking about what that means for us in Lent, and I'm just going to suggest four things. Four things this Lent. The first thing is that we have to be prepared to move. Now, Abraham, of course, moved from Ur of the Chaldeans or whatever it was, where it was, and he moved into a new place, and then God said, I'm going to give you more land. And the point was, he was someone who was on the move. Spiritually, we have to be prepared to move. If we're in a fixed place that's static and that we can't move, it's actually quite hard to grow as Christians and to grow to be like Jesus. And I suppose that is the movement that we want. What does it mean to move? Well, in the Christian sense, it's about moving to be like Jesus. Let me put it to you in this way. If my life is about me and achieving my dreams, then I am on the throne. Okay, I still dream of being playing cricket for Australia. They haven't called me up yet. Even after the ball tampering scandal, I didn't get a call. Disappointed, but I didn't. Okay, that's my dream. But actually, God's biggest story is about becoming more like Jesus. That's the biggest story. That's what God wants me to do. And we do that in a number of ways. We do that by praying, by cultivating a prayer life. One of the problems that we have is we don't have time for God. For a lot of us just don't have time. Do you read the Bible every day? Do you pray? If we don't do the basics, it's very hard to grow. And so we need to set time aside to do that and download an app or do what you need to do that helps you. Talk to me after it. Join a Lent group. Come along on Thursday night to the Vicarage at 7:45 if you've not got anywhere else to go. Do what you need to do, but walk towards Jesus. Do we relate to the people who are hard work on the edge? Because that's what Jesus did all the time. Jesus always went to the tricky people all the time. He was never hanging around with the cool people. Jesus was always on the edge. Do we do that in our lives? That's moving to be like Jesus. And are we prepared to do that? If we are prepared to move, God can work in our lives. The second thing is, are we prepared to believe? Do you remember that verse that I just read out that Abraham believed and it was credited to him as righteousness? And I've been reflecting on this recently that, you know, we can reflect and analyze the Christian faith, and that's great. I think it's really important to really examine it and to think about it and to ask questions about what it means. And as we look at God's promises, we need to do that. But at some point, there is that step of faith, isn't there, that we need to make. In other words, if it's always a bit of a hobby, an interest, you know, like sort of stamp collecting, I'm going to have a look at the Bible and see. You know what I mean? It has to go beyond that. And that's what Abraham did so well. And in the Christian faith, it means actually exploring Jesus' promises and what Jesus calls us to. And Jesus calls us to some pretty big things. Pretty big things. To make Jesus Lord. Seek God's kingdom first. And he says other things will be given to you. But he calls us to be faithful and to be prepared to follow Jesus. And sometimes that's hard. That's actually what we are called to do. We're called to believe and then, of course, to act, because those two things to go together in the Christian life. I've said this before, but, you know, the Christian journey is much more like an apprenticeship than a study course. In other words, as we learn, we apply, and we learn and apply. And that's what he's calling us to do. That's the idea of belief. And the third thing is, are we prepared to sacrifice? Lent has a strong idea of sacrifice. Abraham sacrificed his plans, didn't he? And he said, what does God want me to do? And in the story that goes on with Abraham, he was prepared to sacrifice the thing that was most precious to us, a member of his family, which is hugely controversial and problematic on a number of levels. But it is a precursor to Jesus in Easter and the story that we tell. He was prepared to sacrifice. And I suppose Lent is that idea of giving up things that we can't keep to gain things that we can't lose. We can't really keep all the stuff we've got, ultimately. But to gain that eternal perspective, we need to be able to do that and to put things on aside. And I wonder what that means for us in terms of sacrifice. Well, I don't think it means becoming miserable at all. It really doesn't. The Christian life is not meant to be miserable. It was my birthday when that pig arrived. It was actually Thursday, not Friday. It was my birthday, and I thought, what an amazing present, because it was just hilarious. I mean, pigs are the funniest animals up close. They're just so ugly. And they're so kind of, just, they grunt and they move around, but they are so hilarious. And, you know, the Christian life is supposed to be full of laughter and fun. But there is also an element where we have to be prepared to give things up. You can't just keep filling your life with lots and lots of things, and Christianity is one of us. There is a cost. You have to say no to say yes. And the final thing I think that's really important for us at Lent is that we have to travel the journey together. Lent is not a time to go off on your own and live in a cave for the next 40 days like Jesus. Maybe that didn't quite come out right. I want you to be like Jesus, but do you know what I mean? We're not called to that kind of Lenten sacrifice. We're called to do things differently together. Lent is about a time as a church that we explore things together. Because the church is a community of people who are on a journey together. And I think that's so important as we think of our spiritual lives. It's not something you do on your own. It's important to do things on your own in terms of prayer and that kind of thing. But fundamentally, it's something you do in a community, which is why it's so important to be part of a church. Because that's how it is. It's a sort of group learning process. And I want to encourage us this Lent to think of it in that way. To think of growing, not as something you have to grit your teeth and do on your own, but do together. I said at the first service, slightly controversially, and I had a few raised eyebrows, I hope you've all fallen out with somebody in church. I have people sort of looking at me going, what I mean by that is I hope you have the sort of relationships where you can have a problem, you know, you can actually have a conflict with someone and then resolve it and move on. That's real church. That's real community. What we don't want is a church where there's no conflict. Because frankly, you know, a church without conflict is just superficial. Because we do it together. And if you're exploring life together, you're going to have some conflict, but that's okay. We're okay with that because we're in it together. That seems to me the model of the disciples and Jesus who are always falling out. The model of the early church, who are always falling out. The model of what we've learned in church history. But here's the thing. We go beyond that to actually have not just reconciliation, but relationship. And particularly, we do that in a context of worship. That is what Lent is all about. We're going to just watch a little clip that actually takes on that theme, that really tacks on to that idea at the end about what it is to share the journey together.